The second case on today's oral argument calendar is number A18-2155, Miller versus Public Storage. Counsel, please identify yourself at the beginning of your arguments, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Edward Rooney. I'm the attorney for William Miller, the plaintiff in this action and the appellant in this appeal. Your Honor, Mr. Miller, my client, claims that he lost items of personal property that were valuable to him on account of an unlawful sale of the contents of a storage unit in a facility operated by the defendant in which Mr. Miller's property was being held. Mr. Miller sued Public Storage for conversion, the intentional tort of conversion, and the intentional tort of civil theft pursuant to Minnesota Statute 604.14. In his complaint, he alleged an ownership interest in the property. He alleged that Public Storage, the defendant, deliberately and unlawfully deprived him of that ownership interest, and he alleged that he was damaged on account of Public Storage's behavior. He had other allegations in the complaint, but those were the crucial ones to establish the elements of the torts of conversion and civil theft. Public Storage, in response to the complaint, did not answer, but instead brought a motion to the court for two alternative relief. One, to dismiss the complaint under Rule 1202E for failure to state a claim for which relief can be granted. And alternatively, if that were denied, to consolidate Mr. Miller's action for trial with the action that had already been pending against Public Storage, brought by Mr. Miller's mother and grandmother for the loss of their property on account of the sale of the contents of that storage unit. The trial court granted the motion pursuant to Rule 1202E and dismissed the complaint for failure to state a claim for which relief can be granted. And we appealed from the order. Erroneously, it turned out, the court pointed out that the trial court had also, after it issued the order for dismissal, ordered judgment on the basis of the dismissal. We erroneously appealed from the order dismissing the case. This court pointed out that the proper appeal is from the judgment and that this appeal would be deemed as being from the judgment. Your Honor, the standard for reviewing a trial court order for dismissal of the complaint of a complaint is clear, and the elements are fairly simple. The first one, which is quite important, is it is a de novo review by this court. And we often hear de novo review as being described as this court need afford no deference to the trial court, but actually it's stronger than that. This court may not afford any deference to the trial court. This court has to consider this issue as if it had never yet been decided. De novo, this court is addressing it from the top. So we get past that element. We look to the complaint. Minnesota law says only the allegations in the complaint are considered. Defenses are not considered. The allegations in the complaint are to be taken as true, and all reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the complaint are to be drawn that way.
What if the moving party introduces evidence, puts into the motion record documents that are not referenced in the complaint in support of its motion?
Well, that would be a hypothetical case because it is not. Oh, you're right. It was the moving party. Then we have two things. The court may treat this as a motion for summary judgment under Rule 56, but it may not as well. Both sides agree that this case was a motion for dismissal for failure to state a claim and was treated as that by both parties and by the trial court. And I think it would be litigation by surprise at the appellate level if this court were to all of a sudden evaluate this case as a summary judgment case. But if the court were to go that way, and by the way, counsel for the respondent has pointed out there is appellate authority that even if a document is produced, which the party producing the document regards as essential to the claim, that does not convert the case into a motion for summary judgment. The court may still treat the case as a motion for dismissal for failure to state a claim. But in this case,
I understand your argument about surprise, but must the district court make a declaration that the, you know, this motion is now being converted, or rather, does the motion just automatically convert by operation of law when, you know, when, in other words, I mean, the defendant made its motion, put in some evidentiary material in the manner of a summary judgment motion. I mean, didn't that then put the onus on you to meet that evidence with your own evidence in order to ensure that you could, you know, that...
I hear what you're saying, Judge, but I don't think it did, and I'll explain why.
Okay.
First of all, I can't, as usual, have a hard time finding the authority that was cited by the respondent, but it indicates that the court considering documents that are embraced in the complaint does not render the motion into a motion for summary judgment. In the case is Northern States Power versus Metropolitan Council, 684 Northwest 2nd, 485, cited at page 11 of the respondent's brief. So that's one thing. The court need not, by reason of considering those documents, have converted this into a motion for summary judgment. Another thing is the court clearly indicated through its order in several places that it was deciding this as a motion under Rule 1202E. It dismissed the claim for failure to state a claim for which relief can be granted.
And did the district court confine itself then to only the complaint and the documents referenced in the complaint, or did the district court in fact consider other documents that were beyond the complaint?
Oh, I think it's pretty clear that the district court did consider that contract, but that's what that Northern States Power company says. The fact that the court considered that contract does not render the matter before the trial court into a motion for summary judgment. It may still be a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. But the other thing that's important is...
Okay, that's the point that I would like to explore further, but go ahead.
A motion for summary judgment needs to be supported by affidavits that are firsthand knowledge admissible in evidence. The two affidavits, the affidavit that the defendant submitted in support of its motion to dismiss was an affidavit by defendant's counsel, and it was intended simply to put some documents into the record. One of the documents was this contract that Penelope Eiselman had signed in 2012. Another document was the trial court decision by Judge Walker Jasper in the Anoka County District Court denying my client's motion to intervene in the then existing action. And the other was a letter, a notice by Public Storage sent to Penelope Eiselman at an incorrect address and never delivered to Penelope Eiselman about. But those were by counsel and really could hardly have firsthand knowledge about those. There was an affidavit by a former employee, a man named Michael Joy. I think that was another exhibit to counsel's affidavit, but there was nothing in Mr. Joy's affidavit that said anything that was in there was his firsthand knowledge. So the material, I mean, this is why I believe, notwithstanding considering the contract, the trial court properly continued to consider this as a motion for dismissal because there was no admissible firsthand knowledge evidence. But in so there's that. There's also the fact that William Miller was not a party to this contract. So
I may have interrupted Judge Riley, who had a question.
I'm sorry.
I think. So I have a question for you, and your last statement is a segue into it. So there's no dispute that your client was not on the lease for the storage unit.
That is entirely correct, Your Honor.
And so in your reply brief, you, at page 8, talk about how your client doesn't need to rely on the lease or the lien act as a source of his right to sue for loss of property. So let's say that he's not on the lease and his property ends up in an apartment owned by respondent. Would they still be responsible for that property?
Oh, Judge, you couldn't have asked me a question I'd rather answer, because I can cite you to the Minnesota. There are a
number. I gave you a softball.
You threw me one right down the middle, and I do not wish to strike out, Judge. There is a case decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court. I believe it's somebody versus...
Would be somebody versus
somebody. It's somebody versus a landlord. It's, anyhow, what it was is, and it stands for the proposition that you do not need to be a party to the contract by which the converter came into the property, possession of the property, in order to convert. And this was a person who left some items of personal property in an apartment that a friend was leasing, and the friend defaulted on the lease, the landlord evicted, the landlord wouldn't give the property back. Aha, McKinley versus Flaherty. It's a Minnesota court, it's a decision of this court, 390 Northwest 2nd, 30. And the court held that notwithstanding that the personal property owner was not a party to the lease, the landlord had wrongfully deprived the property owner of possession of that property and was liable to the property owner for conversion. And in the trial court, and if it's an issue that concerns the court, and I'm sorry I cannot cite the cases off the top of my head, but I cited to the trial court in response to the motion for dismiss, 5 Minnesota cases that hold substantially the same thing. And a couple of them had to do with livestock, where different owners' livestock was mixed, and if the conversion was wrongful, it was wrongful as to all the property. And that's the fundamental thing about conversion that it is easy to get mixed up in when you get a contract situation. To my mind, conversion is kind of a, not a relic, but an indication of the days when property rights were afforded extreme protection in the law. And if you messed with someone's property rights wrongfully, you were at risk whether you, there's no good faith defense to the tort of conversion. You interfere with someone else's property rights deliberately, you are at risk, because that's all conversion requires: ownership, deliberate wrongful action without lawful justification and damages. So yes, my client need not have been a party to the lease to assert his rights are based on his ownership and not on any rights under either the lease at contract or under the lien statute that authorizes foreclosure.
So respondent says that you did not raise either the issue that your client was a minor back when this lease was first entered, or a bailment argument below. Do you agree with that?
Well, the record here is so sparse that I didn't raise it. But on the other hand, if you look at the standard for judging whether a complaint is sufficient to withstand a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, it's whether any evidence might be produced that could allow a victory. Now,
So what do we do with the lease contract itself? And I'm looking at the respondent's addendum at page 17. It's paragraph 5 of the lease, use of premises and property. Occupant shall store only personal property that belongs to occupant.
Okay.
So that's a contract term.
It is a contract term. Let's say, you disregard it with respect to the tort of conversion alleged by a third party. If Penelope Eiselman was in violation of that, now, if you look at Mr. Miller's complaint, he says that Public Storage was aware and consented to property of his grandmother's, from his grandmother's home, including his property being in the apartment. Mm-hmm. So that alone, subsequent behavior, shows that the parties waived that agreement or that provision if it might otherwise be binding. But...
Well, that would be a disputed fact, perhaps.
Exactly. Oh, believe me, there's plenty of disputed facts. But if that's not what we look at a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. If you accept as true, which the court must, the allegation, I own this, they wrongfully took it from me, I've been damaged, that should have been the end of the trial court's analysis. And the trial court strayed into erroneous fields by going beyond that.
One of the facts you dispute in the order is that the finding of the court that respondent was not informed in writing of the personal property of Miller.
Oh, we don't dispute that. We dispute that it has any bearing on the case,
okay.
But we don't...
But you don't dispute that there was no written notice to them.
Yep, and it's not necessary, and it would be violation of the lien statute and a violation of Minnesota's well, longstanding public policy against exculpation from intentional torts to allow that to stop a claim for conversion.
Okay. Then in the McKinley case that you cite, there was notice there of that the property belonged to somebody else.
Well, there was a demand.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was.
Okay.
And I don't know, though, that there was a demand, and I apologize for not, but if the other cases that I cited in my memo to the trial court that may basically make the same point that a stranger to the contract is entitled to sue for conversion, I don't believe there was notice in all of those cases.
And, you contend that the district court erroneously considered things outside of the
I contend that it erroneously drew fact findings that were contrary to the complaint and outside of the allegations of the complaint, for sure.
Okay.
It found that there was a required duty of notice. That's not alleged in the complaint. That's a defense. And if you're looking at a prima facie showing, which is the standard here, you don't consider defenses. You just consider, did he allege the elements of this claim? And we did. And if, unless the court has any other questions, I prefer to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You will have 5 minutes of time for rebuttal.
But nothing that's left over from this?
Well, nothing's left over.
Oh, great.
You're about a minute
beyond. Time
flies when
you're having a conversation.
Right, exactly, yeah. We typically allow 5 minutes rebuttal regardless of how much time has been used in the initial argument. Respondents counsel, you may approach and identify yourself and begin.
May it please the court, my name is Abraham Kaplan, and I represent the respondent in this matter. Your Honors, this is a straightforward appeal. This is a question of whether or not the appellant has statutory standing under the Minnesota Lien on Personal Property Act. And because the torts of conversion and the statute under civil theft require and implicate the procedural wrongfulness under the statute, if there's no standing under the statute, then the conversion claim and the civil theft claim must also go away. Now, regarding the specificity in a complaint must establish and give notice on each element of the claim. So if there are three elements, for example, by conversion, the complaint has to cater to each element and establish with facts that the terms were met. Now, this court in Bajwa v. Bailey, a case I cite to in my brief, it says that although absolute specificity is not required in a complaint, some specificity is required. Importantly, sufficient notice of what conduct, by whom, when, and where has to be stated in the complaint. So if the appellant is arguing that general conclusory allegations of wrongfulness can meet that standard, it does not. The respondent in this case was allowed and can demand that what element of wrongfulness is exactly being attacked. Now, in this case, conversion has three elements. Number one, that it was my property. Number two, that it was taken. And number three, it was taken in a wrongful manner. Now, in the entire complaint, and the complaint has 17 paragraphs, only paragraph 8 has any facts going to the wrongful element of the claim, that the respondent's alleged wrongful conduct. And it states that on or about May 27, 2015, defendant willfully and lawfully, number one, without the consent and without any notice. Now, without consent, I'm not sure where that comes from. The statute doesn't require any consent. But importantly, the Lien Act does require notice. So because the complaint, the only claim of wrongfulness is a procedural wrong under the statute, if the statute doesn't allow the appellant to have standing under it to claim that, then the claim must be dismissed.
So what's the intersection? there's other case law, Williamson, that says that conversion has two elements, that the plaintiff holds a property interest and that the defendant deprived the plaintiff of that interest.
So I believe I've cited to opinions where there's a wrongful element. I think if you take away the wrongfulness, if somebody goes into a store and buys a product off the shelf, the property was theirs and it was taken. If it's not wrongful, I don't believe you have a tort of conversion.
Okay, so you would say that the Williamson case should also have included a wrongfulness?
I believe I cited to Olson v. Moorhead, where it's unlawfulness and wrongfulness is articulated, and I think it's necessary for the tort to have. So now going to the specific statute in this case, 514.973 under subdivision 2, it states two categories of people that are required to have notice when a lien is being foreclosed and an auction is being held. Number one, the occupant of a written rental agreement. And number two, anyone who has delivered written notice of a claim of interest. Now, the appellant in his argument was attempting to argue that it's a wrongful inference to say that there was no written notice in this case. However, a complaint, the facts in a complaint that must be taken to be true are only the facts that are stated inside the complaint. So to the extent that the appellant was required to show that he is standing under the statute, it must be an affirmative claim under the complaint that he gave written notice. Because written notice wasn't alleged in the complaint, the court doesn't have to treat it as true and doesn't have to draw an inference of another fact not pleaded into the complaint. But most importantly, I would draw this court's attention to 514.973 subdivision 8, liability for damages, and I quote, an occupant or other person entitled to notice under subdivision 2 paragraph A, which is the one I just cited to, who is injured by a violation of the section may bring a civil action to recover damages. The appellant is not included in subdivision 8. So when they attack the wrongfulness of conversion, they can't cite to the fact that Penelope Eiselman, the mother, didn't receive a proper notice, therefore was conversion against me. The only person that can claim Penelope Eiselman didn't receive a proper notice is Penelope Eiselman.
Well, but here in the complaint, he alleges that Public Storage had notice, actual notice of his interest in the property.
So I would draw the court's attention. I believe Your Honor is talking about paragraph 6 in the complaint. And it states that there was also, during the time the plaintiff rented the unit, defendant was aware that Margaret Eiselman, not William Miller, there is no factual allegation in the complaint that the defendant was aware that William Miller's property was in the unit. Only Margaret Eiselman's property was in the unit.
Well, the allegation is that items of personal property from the former home of Margaret Eiselman, which doesn't necessarily mean that all those items were owned by her, but they were in her home, apparently.
So is Your Honor's position that, therefore, there's notice on everyone? Because anybody's property could theoretically be in Margaret Eiselman's home?
I'm just pointing out what that paragraph says.
So I think the allegation, the complaint, is that Margaret Eiselman, they were aware of Margaret Eiselman's contents in the unit. And I believe the complaint in the underlying sister court action of Penelope Eiselman and Margaret Eiselman against Public Storage, that claim is also reasserted regarding that they were aware of Margaret Eiselman's property, but not William Miller's property. Not that it says we were not aware of William Miller's property, but the allegation is that on Margaret Eiselman, not William Miller. And importantly, even if they were aware, even if the courts does construe paragraph 6 to understand that they were aware of Margaret Eiselman, I don't believe that there's enough allegations in the complaint to say that he's now he has standing under the Lien Act statute, because the Lien Act statute requires written notice under 514973 subdivision 2.
Did the district court decide this issue on the doctrine of standing or by using that term?
I don't think it used the term of standing.
Because you're using that term a lot in oral argument, and I wasn't expecting to have an argument about standing. I mean, he's bringing common law claims.
Correct. There is common law claims, but the common law claims is dependent on a procedural wrong under the Lien Act.
Well, I mean, isn't that your defense? I
think it goes to the question of whether or not there is a claim. So the complaint, and this is why I got into the element of specificity of the complaint in the beginning of my argument. The complaint needs to identify facts of wrongfulness in order to survive a Rule 12 motion to dismiss.
But it doesn't need to plead all of the facts that you would like to rely on to defeat the claim.
Of course not. I'm just arguing that because it has to identify specific facts of wrongfulness, when it identifies that fact, which it does in paragraph 8, that wrongfulness fact has to pass muster. And if the claimed wrongfulness is under a statute which does not allow them to sue under, then it's not a wrong to the appellant.
I want to get back to the procedural question that Judge Johnson asked at the beginning of Mr. Rooney. So do you think that the judge, even though he called this a Rule 12 decision, converted it to a Rule 56 by relying on all those things outside of the complaint and the documents cited in the complaint?
So I believe it's a three-step process to determine whether or not this is converted into a Rule 56. And I would not agree with the appellant's contention that it matters how the district court categorizes it. I believe under I've cited the case law in my brief that I can't bring up now, but I think it's Bush v. City of Lakefield. The court disregarded the procedural rule that's being cited and looked at the rule itself. So again, it's a three-step rule, I believe. Number one, was it inside the record? Was it properly, would it have been properly considered?
Well, there isn't much of a record at Rule 12 stage.
Well, if the complaint embraces a document, which I believe this complaint does, then that would implicate the rental agreement. And orders and an underlying proceeding would be matters of public record. So those two off the bat would be properly be able to be considered even at the early stage of a Rule 12 motion. Number two, if it was not inside the record, was it expressly considered and did the court base its opinion on it? So if it was not inside the record and the court didn't reject it, which the rule seems to imply, that the court has to reject the pleading. If it doesn't reject it, then it converts to Rule 56. The case under Bush v. City of Lakefield says, but it is clear from the comments accompanying the order that the trial court based its decision on matters outside the pleading. I think that has an element of materialness, that it has to be material to the court's decision. If it can be regarded and the decision would stand on its own, then it would still be a Rule 12. But importantly, if the first two factors are met and it converts to a Rule 56, the appellant has to show, it's their burden to show what evidence they would have submitted if they had an evidentiary hearing under Rule 56, and they have to show prejudice. The appellant's complaint, the appellant's brief shows nothing.
So is it your position that, well, this three-step process or analysis you're talking about, is this for the district court to apply or for this court to apply?
This court to apply.
I see. Is it your position that the district court needs to expressly convert the motion from Rule 12 to Rule 56?
I do not. I believe I've stated to case law in the complaint.
I didn't catch your answer. Is it your position that the district court must do so?
No. I believe the procedure that the district court cites to is irrelevant, and what's more important is what the district court actually did.
On page 15 of your brief, you cite to the Manley case, unpublished, saying that appellant, quote, must point to evidence it would have produced had the district court given explicit notice that it would convert the motion, end quote. That seems to imply your argument there, that excerpt from the unpublished Manley opinion seems to imply that the district court has an obligation to give express notice of conversion.
I believe the correct procedure, and this goes to the appellant's claim that there was a surprise of potential surprise of summary judgment, the correct procedure would be for the district court, if it considers matters outside the pleading, to tell the parties and convert it to a Rule 56, and if necessary, hold an evidentiary hearing. But if they do not, which is potentially what might have happened here, the burden is still on the appellant to show evidence that he would have submitted and prejudice. And neither has been argued in the appellant's brief. The appellant has not cited to any evidence that they would have wanted to give in this claim. I believe the appellant admitted that there was no written notice. The appellant admitted that there were not a party under the lease agreement. So if this court does convert it to Rule 56, I don't think the appellant can cry foul that it was improper.
What do we do with appellant's statements that his client and grandma and mother told your client that he was storing his stuff in the unit? Do we do anything with that?
I do not believe the record shows that was correct. I believe the complaint does not state that. Now, it might be looked at as splitting hairs, but I think this element of notice is precisely what would bring somebody under the Lien Act. 514973, subdivision 8, says that only people that gave notice can sue under the Lien Act. So for the appellant to not cite that in their complaint is material, and it could sink the entire complaint. And they didn't request to amend because they're admitting that no notice was given. I believe I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Yes, you are. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Rooney, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Your Honor, as I mentioned in the brief, and I'm glad that the respondent made the argument this way. The respondent's argument that we need to find, the appellant needs to find standing under the Lien Act in order to have a claim, is entirely wrong. The Lien Act, if anything, provides, if the Lien Act's procedures were followed properly, it would provide a defense. It would provide lawful justification for the defendant's taking of the property. But as the court observed, there is no claim in this complaint of violation of the Lien Act at the expense of William Miller. The claim is conversion and civil theft. There is no requirement from William Miller to give notice to converter that the converter is taking his property. That may or may not exist under the Lien Act as a defense, but it is not an element of the claim of conversion, and it is not an element of civil theft. So once again, if the court does not consider defenses, because all the Lien Act does here is, if compliance was there, provide a defense for what otherwise would be an unlawful taking of my client's property. If you don't consider defenses, then the Lien Act is immaterial to the motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. The other thing I'll say is, counsel raised, well, you have to allege wrongfulness. We alleged without lawful justification. What could be more wrong than taking someone else's property without lawful justification? So, as I said, it's even the contract. The contract is not alleged. It's not essential to the conversion claim. It's not essential to the lease contract. It's not essential to the civil theft claim. It happened by way of history to explain how the property came in, how William Miller's property came in to Public Storage's possession, but it is immaterial. What matters here is ownership. And especially at this stage, when you're talking about a dismissal for failure to state a claim. All you have to allege is ownership, deliberate and wrongful deprivation of ownership, and that has been alleged. That should have been the end of the inquiry.
Doesn't it also require knowledge?
By whom? The converter? No. Mm-hmm. Absolutely it does not. There's no good faith. No. You can be entirely innocent, take someone else's property thinking you're taking property you're entitled to, and you can be liable for conversion. That is one of the things that makes me think of old-time law. I mean, you mess with someone else's property, you're at risk whether you thought you were doing the right thing or not. It does not require an element of knowledge.
Whereas civil theft would in your...
I don't believe so. I mean, civil theft requires whatever 604.14 requires, and I've got it stated in the brief, but I just think it's civil theft is also deliberate.
So you're saying they're almost per se.
I'm sorry.
They're almost per se liability. You take someone's property.
Without lawful justification, you're tough luck, buddy. Absolutely. That's why conversion is such a powerful tort. It creates great risk on someone who takes control over property. And that's why the Lien Act is so important, because it provides a defense if it's complied with. And believe me, if this case had been judged in the trial court had said, I'm going to treat this as summary judgment, I'll give you opportunity to put affidavits, we could just put every affidavit from the pending case, the sister case, and we'd establish material disputes on every fact. So the court repeatedly in its decision treated this as a motion to dismiss, and I think that's how this court should treat it as well. Thank you.
Thank you to both both lawyers for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days. Counsel for the third case may come forward and get ready.